Welcome to City Awesome. I'm Matteo Bonetti, joined as always by Nikki Bandini and Mina Rizzucchi. This is the self-proclaimed greatest City A podcast, proclaimed by us. And today we're going to talk about all the hottest topics from the weekend. We're going to talk about Inter, the Scudetto champions elect. We're going to dissect the history of Antonio Conte as a Serie A manager. And does he get enough credit? We'll obviously have to touch upon the whole story with Cristiano Ronaldo, his body language, and his future at Juventus before going into the transfer talk. And also dissecting what's happening at the bottom of the table. There are some potentially big teams that will drop down to Serie B. But let's start with Inter, an 11-point lead, another win. It seems like all they're doing in 2021 is winning and picking up 3 points consistently. They beat Cagliari 1-0 over the weekend. We've already talked about Inter, this period of dominance, every single weekend. So I thought that this could be the right time, Mina and Nikki, to really go into Antonio Conte, his legacy, his history as a manager, where he ranks as one of the all-time Italian tacticians, and maybe as one of the world's best managers. We'll go into his history and say, is he getting the credit that he deserves?
Nikki, I feel like you're his number one fan, so I think you should start off with this.
I'm not his number one fan at all. I have plenty of managers who I'm more enthusiastic about, but I think you and I are going to disagree about it. Tons of managers I think I'm more enthusiastic about. But there's a difference between what I'm enthusiastic about and what I think is going to qualify you in this, this ranking that Matteo wants us to do of who's a great manager. And look, I know some things that you and I don't see eye to eye on. I know that you think his football is not intelligent. I think it's really intelligent. I think he does some things that require a lot of
I don't think it's
creativity.
Not intelligent. I said it was basic, but it's not stupid.
Okay,
football.
Fine. I don't think it's basic. I think it actually requires a very sophisticated manager to do what he does in terms of devising these specific schemes. And I think watching Inter this season, look, I'm not going to disagree with anyone that this has not been a fun team to watch recently. Their games are quite boring. But the way I described it in a column this week was they're like an anglerfish. They just sit there and bring their opponents to them. They say, all right, we'll just sit here and wait for you to show yourself. And when you show yourself, we're going to devour you. And that's what they do over and over again. And look, this season is one conversation, but the conversation that Matteo wants to have is about the bigger picture and who Antonio Conte is. And his personality, very far from my favorite managing personality, but we can argue about whether we like him, whether we like his football, whether we like his style, his person, whether we like his new hairline, whether we like anything about him. But in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, however many years' time, we're still talking about football. People aren't going to have these arguments about whether or not any of that mattered, whether or not giving up 70% possession to Sassuolo was an unimpressive thing for a club of Inter's stature to do. What they're going to talk about is the fact that Antonio Conte took over Juventus and took them after Calciopoli from seventh in the table. He didn't take over a team that was competing even in the Champions League spots, and he won the title with them 3 times in a row. And then he left. And he went to Italy and he took over one of the most unimpressive Italy squads I can think of in my lifetime and beat the Belgium team that was supposed to beat everyone at the Euros and took them to the quarterfinals. And fine, that won't be the first thing people remember, but that's what they will talk about if they talk about his time in charge of Italy, that he overachieved. And then he went to Chelsea and he won the league. And then he came back to Italy and ended the 9-year run of Juventus titles that he started. So all of the stuff that we can say about him, all of the individual traits we don't like about him and things we can pick apart, they can still be valid. But the big picture, Antonio Conte is going to be remembered as one of the best Italian managers of a generation and maybe ever, because this is such a defining era in Juventus' history, and he's the start of it and he's the end of it.
I want to touch upon something Mina said, because there's this constant correlation with this defensive football that we see from Diego Simeone and Antonio Conte, that it's either basic or it's not as intelligent, and you don't ever hear about a defensive philosopher, right? The philosophers in football are always the attacking managers, not the ones who devise a scheme where the team holds on to a 1-0 lead better than anyone else, like Juventus did under Antonio Conte the first 3 years that he was the manager in the early 2010s. The way that they're so good on the counter, the movement on the counter where there's always an option available. Antonio Conte's Inter right now is one of the best counter-attacking teams with Romelu Lukaku that I've seen in some time because there just aren't that many. He's playing a different style than the way that football is supposed to go. And he sort of spearheaded as well a tactical revolution. Let's not forget that before he took over Juventus, he played a game, I think, when he was in charge of Juventus against Napoli, and he saw the way that Napoli were using this back three, and he was so inspired by it that he tried a back three with Juventus. He really went all in with this back three, this 3-4-3, whatever. And all the teams around Serie A started copying him to the point that this seldom-used formation became used by more than half the teams in the mid-2010s because everyone saw, right, that's the blueprint to success. This is the formation of the future. He did the same thing with Chelsea in the Premier League when hardly no one was using a back three. He goes to Chelsea, wins the Premier League 4 years ago. He wins the FA Cup, and he does very well. And like Nicky touched upon, he overachieved massively with an Italy squad that had Emanuele Giaccherini in the midfield and Graziano Pelle and Eder as the two strikers, one of the worst Italy sides that I can remember on paper. And they really did so well in Euro 2016. So for me, Antonio Conte, it's because he doesn't have the 70% possession. If he did, he'd maybe be called the new Pep Guardiola. Like, honestly, this manager does not get enough credit because of how he has this kind of unlikable persona. Okay, maybe I went too far.
I don't think he's
going to
be called the Pep Guardiola. And I don't think the three-man back line is the start of a tactical revolution. It's been done.
It was in the mid-2010s. Almost every team was trying to use it.
Like
in Italy, 60% of the teams were using a back three because they saw Juventus being absolutely unstoppable with it. Juventus had like a 48 or 49 match undefeated streak. You couldn't score against them. It was the best team that we've seen in Italy in the last 12, 13 years since Jose Mourinho's treble-winning side. Nine consecutive Scudetti.
Listen, I think that you both raised really good points. I think you both come in here with like a fight. So either you both like have already keen to state that I'm going to hate him. So you're like, listen, Mina thinks this, so we think that. Yeah, so I don't know what's going on. Yeah.
We're trying to get you to admit that he's one of the best managers of all time, basically.
I am the Juve fan here. And he was my captain. So it's not like I don't know. I'm not a fan of who he is as a coach, but not because I don't think the guy's successful, but because I have an issue with a coach who can only do one thing, let's say, like not one thing, but a style of football that wins in one competition and isn't a guy that can handle three competitions in one go. For me, I have an issue with that because if he was doing it on the budget of Maurizio Sarri at Napoli, then I'll say to you, I understand that. But I do think this Inter side, which is when Cassano came out and said these horrendous things that I don't think is fair to say. I don't think it's bad football. I've never thought defensive football is bad football. A lot of the time, Nikki, do you remember when we were talking about CSKA Moscow and you're like, what is your obsession with this team when they defeated Juventus? I love a team that plays to its strength. So if your strength is defense, then dude, you go out there and you defend. You know, I have no issue with that. Leonardo Jardim is one of my favorite coaches and he knows how to do attacking and defense. I like pragmatism. Whatever you have, you do. I don't think Pep Guardiola is the world's greatest thing. It's in sliced bread, you know? But I enjoy Tele Santana. So it's not like you don't have to have a specific style to be amazing at it. You just have to have balance. I think the criticism of him this season from the likes of Antonio Cassano, from others, is the fact that the team is expensively assembled and seems to be capable of doing a little bit more. And by that is saying, not having to defend a 70, you can park the bus in certain moments of the game, but the quality of play, the engineering, the triangles or whatever, the attacking play is a little bit flanks, cross, in. You know, now with Eriksen, I think that there is a little bit more complex strategies going forward. And I do think they're a little bit more unpredictable. And frankly speaking, and I still go back to this, that performance against Milan for me was outrageously good. Again, I don't know how much you can take this into account because it's not like Milan are like, you know, the world second coming of like Arrigo Sacchi's Milan, you know, nor is any really team in Serie A right now like fighting or scoring from all cylinders. So the competition is a little bit lower this season. what I have, I cannot take it away from him. The guy is a winner. He is so good at turning mentalities around. And I think that's something that he shares with Jose Mourinho. I mean, say what you like about Mourinho, but he was also known as a guy that was defensive and counterattacked. I mean, he used to sit with a stopwatch for the 13-second counterattack at Real Madrid. That's what he's famous for, and defensive football. But you know what? He wins.
The doesn't anymore. That's the difference. That is the difference. Mourinho doesn't win anymore. Conte is still winning.
Yeah, you're right. But no, there's also another difference, Nikki. There's no way I'm going to accept that you're trying to tell me Conte is better than Jose Mourinho. The guy won a freaking treble. Yeah, like as in you try.
He is winning now. What Nikki said is actually true.
It's a longevity.
Conte is winning now. Jose Mourinho hasn't won in a long time.
Spurs against Manchester City that spends $470 million on their defense.
I really accept part of what you're saying because I think that what Mourinho did at Inter and the treble is colossal, and I think that's so unrepeatable. But
statistics about 11 games in
a row. Let me finish this thought. Which is
wait, you interrupted my thoughts. Okay, one second. Let me finish what I was saying. Yeah, what I'm saying to you is that there is nothing that takes away from the fact that Antonio Conte is a winner. But when people try to tell me that he's the best coach since sliced bread, I don't think so. Not because I don't think he can be. You know, this is where we disagree. Lukaku or these players, there's a certain level you grow and you get better. I think Lukaku maybe in 2 years' time can be even better. But right now, for me, the guy doesn't do enough to win in Europe. And I don't care if people count Europa League. Sevilla is not a team that I'm scared of in the Champions League just because they win the Europa League every day. There is a difference. So until he can show me that he's capable of being in three different competitions, playing that exhaustive football and fighting and staying in a competition that lasts more than, you know, like, I don't know, the whole season, then fine. But until then, I'm going to have reservations about his football.
So that's like a different point, which is like, I just wanted to finish on Mourinho because it's not really even about Conte, what I want to say. It's about Mourinho, which is that I think that there is something meaningful about saying that what Antonio Conte has done, he has been able to, whether you agree that he's evolved, I think he's evolved quite a lot, actually. If you go back to when he first started Juventus, he was trying to play a 4-2-4. But whether you agree or not about evolution, he has been able to make this method of his, whatever you think his method is, he's been able to make it successful one place after another, after another. Mourinho did that at the beginning. Mourinho hasn't done that in a while, actually. And that is what's impressive about Conte. That is the thing that stands out to me about Conte. Is it's the same as when people want to talk about, you know, Buffon being the greatest goalkeeper ever. For me, it's a non-argument with Buffon because look how long he did it for. And frankly, every now and then can still do it for. Like, it's extraordinary longevity. And if Conte keeps doing this all through his career, not many managers have done that. Mourinho, for me, has become a parody of himself. He's become completely trapped inside a box of his own thinking. When he started out at Tottenham, it looked like it could go somewhere. But now his football is just overwhelmingly about some idea that he has of himself and his own identity and not about the team. Conte, maybe you could make the same thought actually about him being very ego-driven, but his team is winning. And yes,
where's the context for all of this?
Look, hang on, Mina. He was at Man United before Tottenham. Don't pretend that he's just come from nowhere.
No, I want to talk about Mourinho. We'll finish your point and then I'll
like, he's not exactly had no one to work with. He had Romelu Lukaku to work with, by the way. Didn't get the best out of him while we're on sort of comparisons between the two of them.
No, but I don't know why this is a Mourinho versus Antonio Conte conversation. My issue is maybe Mourinho has lost a lot of the sparkle that he had. I mean, right now he's kind of just annoying to watch. And yeah, by all means, if you ask me right now who I'd rather have, I would also choose Antonio Conte. But I also think that that's a little bit like we're talking about a guy that won a treble with Inter, that won, you know, league titles at Real Madrid, that won the Champions League with Porto, that won the Europa League with Manchester United. I do think there's a level of context that needs to be applied here. At the end of the day, Jose Mourinho is not doing a very good job. But I also think his competition is right now like Manchester City, you know, Manchester United, who beat Milan rather easily in the Europa League. Sorry, yeah. It's not the same level of competition as like Sassuolo and Andrea Pirlo's Juventus that got thrashed by Porto. There's also a level of context to be applied. And when we're talking about when Jose Mourinho came to Inter, he did win a treble. He won a lot of trophies, but on high levels, you know, it was being consistently good in different competitions. Is he not great now? Yeah, possibly longevity. We don't know. Maybe Antonio Conte is only ever good at winning league titles and is And then, you know, you can talk to me about Romelu Lukaku, but then I could talk to you about Diego Costa. I could talk to you about a bunch of players that, you know, Willian Xing him out in the pictures of Chelsea. These are all like, we have to apply context to everything. You know, there's some people that will follow Jose Mourinho to the fire, and there's some people that will follow Antonio Conte to the fire. They're both very good coaches. Are they either Pep Guardiola? I don't even think Pep Guardiola deserves the title of Pep Guardiola anymore. You know, I hate it.
Did you ever think that? I thought that when Matteo brought Guardiola in, I was like, that's the last person you should be throwing out at me.
I get irritated when Sacchi speaks. So I don't know. You know, like everyone has their benefits and everyone has their, you know, Carlo Ancelotti, I think, is one of the world's best, but Bayern thought he was rubbish. So I think.
But Mina, you understood my point about Pep Guardiola. It's more that he has this cult following because people are enamored so much by the way that his Barcelona played, which was one of the best teams that I've seen in my lifetime. But, you know, because it's attacking football, because it was tiki-taka, it was quick passing, it was so many goals. Whereas managers who do the exact opposite, like look at Diego Simeone, how he's overachieved time and time again with Atletico Madrid, sending them to the Champions League final. It's not pretty football to watch, and it's actually changed quite a bit. But in the past, it was the most counterattacking, defensive, hardworking football, like the Antonio Conte version in La Liga. And I don't see that cult following saying, oh, I can't wait to watch a Diego Simeone Atletico Madrid match, because it is defensive. And that's why there's this constant negative connotation applied to defensive football, as if we want every team to play the same, then football wouldn't be fun. I love seeing the difference in balance, and all the top managers have their identity.
Call Sacchi, call your stupid Cruyff, your, you know, like as in the Cruyff followers, and tell them maybe we can have different styles of football. We can appreciate all of them, you know? I mean, Zidane is still called the guy who puts 10, 11 players up in a matchup. The guy can win everything he wins and no one rates him. So there's always going to be subjective opinions. And sadly, anyone who knows how to defend is a loser.
Nikki, we have to talk about Conte in Europe, because that was something that both of you briefly touched upon. And it is the one sort of mark against his career, where at Juventus, he made that famous or infamous comment that Juventus were going to a 100 euro restaurant with a 10 euro note, basically saying that we're not good enough. And I guess if you actually look back in history and say, right, who were the top teams that year? It's not like Antonio Conte ever had a Juventus side, and his early Juventus sides weren't even nearly as good, I think, as the Allegri side. I think the Allegri Juve was the best one of the last decade. Antonio Conte's Juve was never a favorite. They were never even a top three in the Champions League. So is it harsh to criticize Antonio Conte because he's never won in Europe, given that it's something that takes a lot of luck, that's so hard to do? I mean, just look at PSG, all the money they've thrown, that 5-year plan. Now it's become a 10-year plan. Is it a bit unfair to always go back and say, ah, but he didn't do it in Europe?
I think actually what it is a certain amount of pick your poison. And I think there's a really easy parallel that we can draw here with clubs, actually. And perhaps it's not even a parallel, because Conte is part of one of those clubs historically, even if he isn't right now. When you look at Italian football as an observer, which do you think is the grander history? Do you think it's Juventus, who have always been the most successful club domestically, who have won the most titles in Italy? Or do you think it's Milan, who've won the most Champions Leagues, who've won the most European Cups? And that's a philosophical argument and disagreement that people will always have. I think there will be plenty of people who will say, no, of course it's Juventus. The league is the hardest thing to win. To do that over 38 games it is right now, it's sometimes been more, sometimes been less. But when you have to do it over 9 months to a year, and you've got to keep going, and you do it year after year, the simple numbers of it are higher as well. Like the number of leagues that Juventus have won is more than the number of European Cups that Milan have won. So is that the most impressive thing to you? Or is it Milan, who've had the great European nights, who've had those moments, who've had their revenge game against Liverpool, even after they had the most upsetting night probably in the club's whole history, friendly against Liverpool, they got to avenge it, which evokes something more in you? And that's, people are never going to agree on that completely. It's one of the reasons, actually, that Mina, you want to know which managers excite me. I mean, managers who I've loved in my football watching and following career.
Marco Giampaolo?
Not my club, but Ancelotti, because his Milan teams were made you swoon, so because he did it with a smile, because he always had that eyebrow raised. I'm an optimistic person, in case people haven't picked that up from listening to this podcast all year. I like people like that. It's a reason when My actual club, which isn't even in Italy, Arsenal, were managed by Arsene Wenger. I loved it because he felt like an optimist, at least at the beginning. And that's what excites me. Conte doesn't come across as an optimist, and so it doesn't touch my spirit in the same way. But I also think that what I said at the beginning is still absolutely true. What you and I think of his football right now is not what his legacy is. What his legacy is what the success is. And yes, Matteo is totally right that if he gets to the end of his career and he still hasn't done it in Europe, some people are always going to say, well, he didn't do it in Europe. And it's a valid criticism. Even this season's success, you can say, would they have done it if they had Champions League games to play into March, into May? But in the same way as lots of people will say, no, Juventus is the best team in Italy, look at all the titles they've won, I think it would be very hard to argue with anyone who looks at Conte's, again, starting and ending this era of Juventus domination and says he's one of the best there ever was.
And Nikki, I almost look at it, the people who say the Champions League, Antonio Conte, the disappointment, it's almost like the same crowd that talks about Lionel Messi and says, I didn't do it with Argentina. It's such a smaller sample size than what you do domestically. Most of a team's games and the coach's games as manager are in the league. And that's where Antonio Conte has picked up all of his accolades. And we've watched enough football to know how much luck goes into the Champions League, about the draw, about the group that you're in. And yes, this year was a massive disappointment for Inter to finish fourth. And I think if you had the Inter of this second half of the season, they would have finished first or second in the group. And they would have definitely created noise because it's like a Jekyll and Hyde from the beginning of the season to the end of the season. So it's a bit unfair, I think, overall, because Antonio Conte, I think we can all agree, has at least had a very successful career and has been a pioneer of sorts as well. Maybe not a fun pioneer, and maybe does have this persona that doesn't excite Nikki and doesn't get Nikki to want to root for the guy. But maybe he's also changing. We're seeing the version Fonte, right, that we've been talking about over the last few weeks, where he's a bit more jolly, and maybe it's a PR rebrand of himself where he's trying to be a bit more, you know, just this kind of likable, jolly guy, which it still seems like an awkward transition, but it's happening.
Listen, I do think there is a popularity contest over here. Like, you know, we keep talking about 2016 and how well, I mean, God, you would think Conte won the damn competition, yeah? I mean, I'm really sorry, but like, as in Mancini's doing a terrific job, and I just feel like no one really talks about it, and he's doing it with a bunch of children, okay? And half these children perform better for Mancini than they do for their own clubs, Bernardeschi being number one, you know? So I do think that there is this weird thing about either people feel like they got to defend Conte to the fire or they got to argue against him, you know, and I think we have examples of that on this podcast, you know, you and me, whatever. But to sit there and say to me that like he will definitely have gotten far in the Champions League and Pep Guardiola and his billion-dollar squad haven't managed to get past the quarterfinal, and they play what everyone describes as the most scintillating football. So to say or to even imagine that Conte would do better for me is pure conjecture. We have absolutely no idea. And at the end of the day, you know, football is about, for me, it's, you know, it's like what Allegri said when he did his conversations with Sky Italia. It is about adapting to the game. It is about changing your tactics at that moment to suit your opponent and make sure they are defeated. There is a different coach from Monday to Friday and a different coach on the actual match day. That has always been Antonio Conte's flaw. No one is saying you should win the Champions League. I think that's a very hard thing to do. Marcello Lippi had several tries at a final and failed a lot of them, by the way, you know, and he's one of the best coaches in Italy. That's not the question. The question is losing to Nord Land or Galatasaray, or not managing performances that you can say, you know, or coming out after Shakhtar and saying, well, they play differently to the way they played against us last time, so I think it's really unfair. No, you need to show me that you can adapt to your opponent, that you are putting in performances worthy of it, and they don't last just 45 minutes. So it's not about wanting or expecting a trophy to come out of it. It is about progress. And right now in Champions League, and what he is doing is that, as I don't see evidence of that progress. We can say there's evidence of tactical revolutions in his own identity. He went from a 4-2-4 and whatever when he was quite inspired by Ventura, which is where it came from, watching Pisa and Ventura, the 4-2-4, to where he is now. But at the end of the day, there's not enough for me of a revolution to want to go into the fire with him. But I do think he's a winner, and we shouldn't take that away from him. But also, can we just say that this is Pirlo's Juventus? It's not Allegri's Juventus. So let's not say like, oh my God, this guy has overachieved beyond everything because his competition is so high. It is high. He deserves a lot of credit for winning it. He deserves a lot of credit for changing the mentality of Inter. But I'm not going to tell you the competition was super strong this year.
Nikki, final thoughts on this?
I know producer Tom wants us to get moving. I had like a few like things I wanted to say on that. First of all, Marcello Lippi is the great example of a manager who like emotionally, like his football isn't the kind of football that I would say I connected to hugely, but yeah, will forever be one of my favorite managers because I have a separate emotional moment of he won Italy the World Cup. Yeah. And yeah, I'm Italian, and it happened in my lifetime at an age where I could appreciate it. And so he's always going to be the best ever almost in my mind because he did that for me as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, we're going to get into the reads if we keep going on this. I think you're uncharitable to Conte on the adjustments. I think the fact that Inter this season have scored about 70% of their goals in the second half of games shows exactly that they do adapt and make changes. They have got all sorts wrong in those Champions League games, but I think it's not fair to say that he doesn't adapt things in game.
I think Mina's mentioning of Giampiero Ventura was the ultimate sign that it is time to move on. Inter play Napoli this weekend, huge battle for the top four. It was a much better performance over the weekend from Juventus, a 3-1 win against Genoa. Goals from Dejan Kulusevski, Weston McKennie, Alvaro Morata. Very good performance as well from Juan Cuadrado, who is banging assist after assist into the box. So let's start with the actual performance. Was this a sign of maybe a strong finish to the season, a guaranteed top four, or just another typical inconsistent stretch for Juve where 1 week they're losing against Benevento and then they actually play up to their potential or close to the potential?
It's an interesting one because I feel like with Juventus, the defense is what has let them down recently. They seem to have forgotten how to defend as a team or to work even as a unit. And somewhere along the lines, you know, the train went off track and Pirlo really struggled at putting it back in there. I don't know what his excuses are for this, whether it's absences. With this team, obviously, we all know that I have issues with the way that it was assembled. I don't think it's a very good team in terms of balance and you know, enough ball players, enough, you know, runners, all of that. But it is interesting to see that when they are geared up for it and when they are pressing up front and they are really determined to try to overwhelm with their attacking potential, that they can be rather good. I thought they were very good in the first half. Again, I don't want to talk too much about this because it's Genoa and I find them to be, you know, rather poor. So it's very hard for me to draw conclusions from that. But I do think there's an element of, there's a psychological breakdown because as soon as Ballardini tried to make his adjustments, you know, which makes him now, because he made adjustments, he must be as good as Antonio Conte, and did actually introduce a few strikers, Shmurdov eventually, and changed the lineup, they looked strong. And when they did, you could just see how Juventus deflated. And there was that sense of insecurity again that happens to Crotone. You know, there isn't that intimidation that we so associate with the name Juventus. You know, before you used to play Juve and you're a little bit scared to play Juve because you just think that they're going to just overwhelm you the whole time, but they've lost that and they've lost it within themselves. So the fear factor that came in the second half suggests there is something on a psychological level. They don't believe in themselves. The frustration obviously evidenced by Ronaldo. I think there's a lot of work to do and it has to start from scratch on a mental, on a physical. Like, this is a good performance, but I mean, again, I think half the time they were lucky. So, but there's just so much work to be done with this team that it's very hard to judge them right now.
Yeah, I think it's too late in the season for me to believe that I'm going to come away with any particularly different impression of Juventus, unless, like, if they won every game remaining this season, maybe that could change something, or if they lost every game, but it's just not, it's too not linear. There's too much sort of regression and then forward progression from 1 week to the next. There's too much sort of moments of things coming together and then moments or whole games like the Torino game where you're just looking around and thinking, what's the plan? What's anything? Yeah. What's any of this? It's just a bunch of players who don't look like they're working together. There's individual pieces I like. I feel like I've talked about a lot of those ad nauseum. You mentioned Cuadrado in this game. I haven't talked about him so much. I quite like him as a player. Mina, I think, doesn't. Not that we disagree on everything, but that just came up while we were off air. I don't know. I'm not going to come away from this season thinking I have some great handle on this Pirlo team unless something really dramatic changes in the last 2 months of the season.
Speaking of Pirlo, Mina, Andrea Pirlo gave himself a 6 out of 10 this season, which in Italy is considered sufficient. Has it been sufficient?
Well, it depends on if we're judging him as Andrea Pirlo, I just graduated and this is my first job, or we're judging him as the fact that we're by the standards of Juventus, who are 9 times winners. And I think people can, you know, it tends to all overlap. And so I feel like it's almost like sometimes people set it a marker down for themselves, and Juventus obviously have, and they've been winning under every coach. But despite the fact that Maurizio Sarri had so many struggles, it was obvious that there's something wrong with the team, because even Allegri did in his last season, and we just deemed it to be that he was, you know, it just all became a little bit stale. Got rid of him, brought in Sarri, still problems. Pirlo came in, more problems, except now we don't have an experienced man on the bench. So I feel like a lot of these things are counted against him because we're judging him by the level of Juventus. If he had come in and done a reasonable job with Sampdoria, he might have been given Milan job like Marco Giampaolo was, you know. But at the end of the day, we're basically asking him to defeat Antonio Conte's Inter, to do better than a Milan side that had come out of lockdown doing incredibly well and continued that trend and investing in the team. And while he should still do it because he has a team capable of it, I think we also need to make allowances for the fact that he has no experiences and cannot manage the moments as well as certain others. Having said all of that, I do agree with what he judged himself on. I wish him the same thing. He's already walked out with a trophy. It's not a great trophy by all means, but he reached the next stage of the Champions League, got unfortunately defeated by Porto, and it was embarrassing for him. But having said that, Sarri got defeated, Allegri got defeated by rather embarrassing opponents as well. And so the fact that he at least helped make money in Europe, gotten them through to the Coppa Italia final, has beaten the likes of Barcelona, Napoli, Milan, Inter in the Coppa Italia. I think that it's not such a bad season for, let's just say, a rookie who's never done this job before in a day in his life and hasn't got a midfield.
Nikki, there were rumors that Max Allegri told Juventus's board that it's time to move on from Cristiano Ronaldo. We also saw Cristiano Ronaldo over the weekend yet again with some poor body language. The attitude doesn't really seem like the same that we saw in the past or in the first half of the season. Is this nervousness just typical nervousness, or a player that's looking to leave after getting ousted from the Champions League and probably realizing this team isn't good enough right now for what Cristiano Ronaldo wants to win?
I thought there was this, like, amazing, I don't know if this, I was going to say amazingly Italian, maybe it happens in other countries as well now I think about it, but this amazingly Italian over-analysis of what happened at the end of that game, because he threw his shirt and it wound up on the floor, and then there was an initial sort of backlash against that, and then there was, oh, but someone says they heard the ball boy say, oh, could I have your shirt, and so he's throwing the ball to the ball boy, and then they looked at the video video analysis, the video replays, and you can see that the ball boy does go and pick the shirt up. So maybe he was just throwing the shirt, and it's just so like obsessive about this one moment that to me didn't feel in itself like that big a moment. I mean, this wasn't, in body language terms for me, this was a very different gesture to, for instance, him throwing the Portugal arm mat where he's clearly angry. This was a more resigned sort of not paying attention kind of moment. Having said that, he was certainly a bit stroppy on the pitch, it felt like, during that game. And I think that maybe actually more than any of that detail, what interests me about this conversation is this is now part of what Juventus have to ask themselves in the Ronaldo value equation. Do we want every game, every week, to have all of the attention around our club be on, did Ronaldo have the right body language as he was walking off the pitch? Do we want to have that be for another year? Because you know you're going to have that with a player like him when he came in, right? It was like that from day one. Every conversation about, oh, he got substituted, was that okay? What look did he give to Allegri? What look did he give to Sarri? At the beginning, there was no ambiguity. He's worth the extra fuss. He's worth the extra attention. He's bringing good things to our club. He's scoring goals. He's going to take us to the next level. 3 years down the line, he's 3 years older. He's got 1 year left on his contract. The conversations around him are going to be more intrusive next season if he stays, because he's in the final year of his contract. So I do think that's the sort of more interesting part of this for me now, is Juventus have got a huge decision this summer about whether or not they want to do this presumably last year with him. I don't really know what options they have if they don't, because I'm not sure who's rushing to take that contract off them, but that's the position they're in right now. They have to decide, do we want this fuss, and can we give him what he needs to make the most of his talent? Because look, if you spin this around and look at it from Ronaldo's perspective, he has scored the goals. All right, he didn't this weekend, but his scoring record all through his time at Juventus has been pretty solid, more than pretty solid. It's been typically Ronaldo levels of extraordinariness. We start to think it's just normal, but it isn't. It's Ronaldo. And he came here very clearly with an idea in his head about how he was going to write another chapter in his career. He'd won everything at Real Madrid. What could make my legacy, my history as a footballer, even more spectacular? Go to one of the other great clubs in Europe, help them to do something that they haven't been able to do without me. That was the narrative. And that narrative emphatically now has not happened. In 3 seasons, the Champions League results have gone backwards. And now for the first season in 10, Juventus aren't going to win the league. The fact that Ronaldo is disappointed and unhappy, I think you don't need to have his ear to know that. You just have to have basic thinking about the situation to know that he's not happy about what's gone on this season. The question, I've addressed it from Juventus's side, is kind of even more urgent on his side now. What do you want to do about it? And that question for me remains one of the big open narratives going into this summer.
Let's talk about the teams that have actually been linked to Cristiano Ronaldo, right? PSG, Real Madrid. How many teams genuinely can afford him and his mammoth wages post COVID and the financial hits that so many leagues and so many teams have taken? I mean, we've all seen the financial reports coming out of Italy, out of Juventus. It looks very grim, and it's still going to be some time before teams are able to get 100% capacity at stadiums. I know that now they're talking about 25% capacity at the Stadio Olimpico for Euro 2020 this summer. But Cristiano Ronaldo, if he does leave, it's not like he has a host of teams. Everyone's going to want him, but what team can actually afford him? Because it looks pretty slim. And would it be a case of, if it is Real Madrid, a return to his former club where he was such a legend and won the La Decima and so much more, is it going to have to be a case where Juventus can actually say, you know what, we'll take him and him in return. Real Madrid can offload a few wages. Maybe Juventus can actually get some real quality in return for Cristiano Ronaldo.
Real Madrid, I don't think that's even a destination. I think that they want to go all in on Mbappe. I think that's where they would like to see themselves, as try to go younger. And I know that people always associate him back to that, because obviously there's still his friends in Benzema and Sergio Ramos, but I'm fairly confident of the fact they don't want that to happen. So the next alternative, like you mentioned, is potentially PSG. If, say, they do lose the likes of Mbappe or Neymar to a potential team, I don't think it will be Neymar, but it could well be Mbappe. And if so, they could probably handle their wages, but is it necessary? Because the way that they are performing right now, the type of the duality of the role that has been accepted by Neymar and Mbappe, the way that they're running and defending and helping the team, it is tactics suited better for the younger man. Having said that, I'm always going to believe that Ronaldo makes any team better. Obviously, age has to be counted, so that is something to look at. I genuinely actually don't think he wants to leave Juventus, to be frank with you. I don't think he wants to go. I think his family is quite happy there, and I think that there's a part of him that doesn't want to walk out without being able to shove something in people's faces, you know? I think there is that still that desire to be like, just give me one more shot and I'll show you, but you've got to help me out. So I think, if anything, I would like an angrier Ronaldo. I do want a Ronaldo that walks into that management room and demand a certain level of you know, a better midfield. Let's say, you know, the guy had Toni Kroos and Luka Modric, obviously, and Casemiro and Isco and whoever he wanted. You know, right now he's pretty much got, he doesn't even have Dybala. So I think that it is, there is a certain level of, I need you guys to actually be on board with this. What we have to understand is that Juventus need to make 100 million for their accounts to balance by June. So how much money they have to spend is going to be difficult as well. So I don't know whether they can make him happy as much as they can. But this is why I don't know what's going to happen with Pirlo's future, because as much as it's very nice to continue this romantic trend and see how Pirlo develops with this team, they can't afford to do that when you've got a guy on £30 million wages and you've got potentially the likes of other coaches coming in that can maybe guarantee success a little bit quicker. And then maybe we can go back to Pirlo and start this journey with him again. I don't know.
I think that's a great point you just made, because I sort of painted the picture of it's not gone how... Ronaldo wanted this for his legacy. There is still a way to fix it if you stay that last year. If you stay that last year and you win the Champions League, suddenly that whole dream has come to fruition. And in fact, you can even make it into a better story. Look how he overcame the adversity. Yeah. But it's a gamble, you know, it's a gamble for him and it's a gamble for Juventus.
I mean, to be honest, even when he arrived at Madrid, you remember they kept losing to Lyon twice in a row. There were problems and many teething problems with Real Madrid before Mourinho came in and started getting to semi-finals and then to the decima with Ancelotti. There's always been, and Neymar moved to PSG hoping to be the guy that won the Ballon d'Or, hoping to be the guy that changed everything for PSG. And that's also been a journey for him. It's only really last year that they managed to reach the final that they lost, you know, his injuries. Sometimes things don't work out very quickly. And even if Ronaldo and Messi are the very best, they can't just walk into teams and win everything with them, you know. And so I think that there is that, but there's got to be a collaborative effort. And to put it all on him, which I think that the media likes to do quite a lot and read into every demand and everything, I think we're allowed to be frustrated. I think we're allowed to be angry, you know. So I can totally understand where he's coming from. And if anything, I just think the team's let him down and maybe they'll try to make it right for the last year, or maybe they won't. We don't know.
Following what Juventus do this summer in the transfer window is probably going to be one of the most interesting storylines, given the problems that they need to address in the midfield. Juve have a tough game as well this weekend against Atalanta, which is strangely very difficult to say a battle for one of the top four spots. If Atalanta win, Juventus once again need to look at that fifth place, which is where Napoli is. Napoli, remember, also have to take on Inter. So that battle for top four is going to be crazy. Another team that is in that battle is Milan. And Milan won 3-1 against 19th place Parma last weekend. But the overriding story wasn't so much what happened on the pitch, Nikki, but what happened with Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
Yeah, so Ibrahimovic got himself sent off for talking to the referee. There's been a whole several days of media coverage about what exactly he said to the referee and what was written down in the referee's notebook. The long and short of it is that he will get, I hope I'm right on this, I'm pretty sure it was a one-game ban that Ibrahimovic is going to get for it. And then the story sort of gets followed in quick succession with another story about Ibrahimovic being photographed out at a meeting inside a restaurant, which shouldn't be open because Lombardy, which is where Milan is in Italy, is currently in a designated red zone, which means that all restaurants should be shut. So you had these two concurrent stories. One, Ibrahimovic, supposedly Milan's leader, gets himself a needless red card and lets his team down and puts them in a tough spot, even though they find the win. And then this other negative story, Ibrahimovic, who has been actually the face of some coronavirus publicity campaigns in Italy, you know, look after each other, you know, do the right thing, social distancing, all the rest of it, that sort of messaging, is now perhaps has broken some regulations around that as well. Now, there has been a counter sort of argument on that one. They said they weren't having a meal, Ibrahimovic and the people with him. They were just having a meeting and it was within the rules. I think that is an argument we won't get into, but it's two negative storylines in quick succession for him. And I think in some ways there's an easy parallel with the Ronaldo story, which is just that when you have someone who's got this much of an aura around them, this much of a presence, this much of a media coverage around them, you have what becomes a double-edged blade. you have someone who can give you so much, but also who can become a distraction really quickly. And perhaps Milan in a different equation to Juventus, but perhaps they also have to ask themselves the question of, right, when Ibra first came, it was inarguably great for the club and he brought this massive lift that we needed. Is he still providing that? Is he going to keep providing that? Or is this one of those relationships where you need to know how to walk away, painful as it might be, before things do go in a really bad direction? I don't know. I'm not saying they do. I think that's perhaps we're going to have a more nuanced conversation about that heading into the summer with Milan than we might have imagined a few months ago when everything was perfect and they were top of the league.
Matteo, can I ask you, like, what do you, I mean, considering the fact that, you know, contract renewal, all of that, Zlatan, you know, absorbs a lot of sometimes the negativity, which makes it easier for the kids in the team to not be focused upon as well. You can sometimes say that him being in the headlines helps them a lot. But as somebody who watches the team probably more than, I guess, both Nikki and I, would you, the 13 matches he's missed, there's been controversy against Lukaku, there's been controversy now, although Maresca is now becoming rather famous for wanting to be the protagonist of pretty much all Serie A matches. so would you keep him on board, knowing that this is one of the youngest teams in the now in European football? It's already been documented, fourth youngest team. So is this a guy that you do want on board because it's important, especially when I ask, especially because Alethi mentioned this thing about the San Siro atmosphere, which is so overwhelming, and how, like, when he arrived, he was like, I didn't realize it was going to be this big, you know? And it's interesting to see sort of a little bit why maybe Inter went for more experienced individuals, but it is COVID. There aren't, you know, atmospheres. They are still losing games in San Siro with an atmosphere where there's no fans. So is Ibra the right person to continue ahead with?
Yeah, funnily enough, Stefano Pioli actually said that having no fans has helped Milan, that a lot of the players that were nervous before, like Hakan Çalhanoğlu and a lot of the youngsters, as you mentioned, the youngest average age team, they were able to settle in without 80,000 plus screaming at them, especially in the position that Milan are at. You could expect the San Siro to be absolutely packed and the whistles to come when things aren't going their way. As for Zlatan Ibrahimovic, I mean, I've seen every single minute of Milan since I can remember. And I've also seen the incredible night and day change that his arrival has brought, along with Stefano Pioli, obviously. But since Zlatan Ibrahimovic came, if you combine the second half of last season and the first half of this season, Milan would have had the points to win the Scudetto in most years, right? But unfortunately, football doesn't work that way. Even though he's missed a ton of games, I don't see how you can let go someone who, forget his age, because it doesn't matter with Zlatan. He's performing at a higher level statistically than he ever has in his career. He's scoring at the rate that he did in MLS, almost a goal a game. He's been absolutely incredible, and he's doing it in a league where strikers tend to be able to extend the tail end of their prime for a few more seasons and really hold off that twilight of the career. And it feels like Zlatan's still in that prime, so I would keep getting him these short-term deals. It's going to cost a lot, another short-term rental, another season, and then you see where it goes from there. Obviously, can't play forever, but I love having Zlatan there as the leader, as the guy that can guarantee you goals when nothing else is going right. And the difference from when he's playing to when he's not playing, Milan don't have a striker now. There's also rumors that Milan want to get Dusan Vlahovic. We'll go into that in the next segment. But Zlatan Ibrahimovic, with his production, okay, there's stuff that's happened off the pitch, but he needs to stay another season. He is the leader of that team. He is the one that genuinely has the world-class ability that no one else on the team has. So for me, he sticks around, and we'll talk about the transfer segment in the next one. There's some names, some big names as well, especially strikers that have been linked to move to a bigger club. Nothing gets us excited more than a good rumor, so we'll go into the two biggest transfer rumors that we've seen pop up in the last week, and they both have to do with strikers. Now, the first one, Nikki, has to do with Andrea Belotti, who's been at Torino for such a long time. At once upon a time, he was scoring nearly 30 goals in the season. Urbano Cairo, the Torino president, said that he was worth 100 million euro, and now he's also attracting interest from Premier League sides. So at the moment, the apparent suitors are the big teams in Italy, and then Manchester United, Chelsea, and Tottenham, all on the trails of Andrea Belotti, who once again is carrying a very poor Torino. Should he finally move on?
He definitely won't move on for 100 million. I'm sorry to disappoint everyone. It's not a market right now. I worry about Belotti fitting into a pattern that I feel like I see happen way too often, which is, we've talked before a little bit about this, like there are certain stereotypes about different leagues that all those stereotypes have some truth to them. And one stereotype we could say is that the Premier League is this physical league where having a bit of heft to you like is a meaningful thing because it is a high contact sport, Premier League football. And I feel like Belotti looks like a Premier League striker because he's got some of that to his game, right? So much more than, say, his rival for the Italy job, Immobile, he's much more about having that contact with a defender, having a little bit of a tussle. He can handle that a bit. But the fact that he stands out a little bit for that in Serie A doesn't mean that he would stand out for it in the Premier League, where everyone's got that and is probably better at it than he is. I just don't know with Belotti. I think we always want to categorize players as great or terrible, and I think he's neither of those things. But to me, I'm not sure he's ever going to be the sort of striker that a top level club needs. I don't think he's got enough nuance to his game. I think he does have good instincts and, you know, superior, above average finishing talents and ability to get himself free in the box. But I don't think he has elite level, maybe anything. And I think that's what clubs like Manchester United are looking for. And I don't think he's got it.
That's a really good point. Siniša Mihajlović once said that Belotti, if he didn't work as hard as he did, he'd just be a mediocre striker. So much of his game is just fighting and winning the ball. And he's a very good goal scorer in Serie A, but I would agree with you that there is really no element of his game that would be seen as brilliant. And there's also a reason why he's been, for the large part of his prime now, at Torino, a team that's always in the bottom half of the table, that most seasons is fighting to just stay up in the top flight. And you'd think that if you had that next level ability, probably would have moved on by now. A player that is looking to move on earlier than Belotti did is the recently turned 21-year-old Dusan Vlahovic, who's had 15 goals for Fiorentina and has really taken a step up in his career. I think he's shown everything this season: physique, technique, he's pacey, he can link up with teammates, and he scores some spectacular goals. Mina, do you think he should move on from Fiorentina? It seems like Milan are interested as maybe the new post Ibrahimovic.
Well, the thing is with him is that it seems like he did a lot better under Cesare Prandelli than at the time with Beppe Iacchini. Although having said that, Iacchini's back in and he's still scoring. He is a player that is renowned for the way that he trains. He is an immense trainer, nonstop. He has this huge desire to make it to be one of the very best. And it's almost like you just can't get him to stop training. And that is huge. But it depends on the synergy and the communication and what he feels with Iacchini. What's going to happen with Fiorentina? Because it seems like they have all these ambitions, but they don't actually come to fruition. So it's not about where his, you know, he's still young. He should stay probably at Fiorentina. But I also think that he needs to stay with a coach that he trusts and that he feels is exploiting his maximum talents and able to show that every day. He had that with Prandelli. Does he have that with Iacchini is the question.
So we just mentioned Dusan Vlahovic and Andrea Belotti, two players that are currently playing for teams in the bottom half of the table. But I think we've spent so much time analyzing the top four in Serie A, and we haven't really gone in depth on the bottom four, which is obviously the biggest fight right now to stay in Serie A and all the money that that brings, and also the doom for teams when they do go down to Serie B. Torino and Cagliari, two teams that are fighting to stay in the top flight. Also managed by two managers, Nicky, that once upon a time were seen as the future of Italian football, Marco Giampaolo and Eusebio Di Francesco. Is there a pair who's had their stock drop so much, so precipitously in the last 3 years than those two?
Well, I mean, Giampaolo has gone from being in charge of Milan and the future of Milan, and look at this ambitious counter to Antonio Conte. I feel like I probably over-repeat this anecdote, but the great sort of back and forth between them when Conte was talking about what Inter need to do and said, testa bassa e pedalare, which is put your head down and pedal. And Gianpaolo said he was going to ask his players to keep their heads up and play the ball. Well, we all saw how that worked out. He's someone who had this very great sense of himself and had this great reputation as an up-and-coming proponent of attacking creative football. And that has, yes, clearly gone backwards very sharply in his career and since that time at Milan.
Mina, before I go to you, because I know you have thoughts about this, I met Milan two summers ago, I think. The time has just kind of been warped since the pandemic. But when Milan were training in Boston, it was the first few weeks of Marco Giampaolo at Milan. And what I noticed and what it seemed to me from the players is that I'm not sure if he's Giampaolo, the kind of motivator, the man manager. It seems to me like someone who was just lacking a bit of charisma that... It just seemed a bit, I wouldn't even say dull, but just lacking that personality, that fire to really bring the best out of teams. And it really has not worked out for Giampaolo, either at Torino or at Milan. But where do you stand on these two managers? Both quote-unquote philosophers. Giampaolo was seen as the new Maurizio Sarri after he took over for him at Empoli. Eusebio Di Francesco at Sassuolo was the one who birthed this kind of, you know, overachieving small-town side that made the top half of the table.
I think that so let's start off with Marco Giampaolo. Any coach who disappears after a loss, like he did at Brescia, tells you a lot about who he is as a man. For me, I had issues with him then. I think his tactics when he was in charge of Siena were nothing short of ridiculous. I always felt like he got a lot of credit because at one point Juventus thought he was this great coach. Prandelli actually also said that because I think maybe because everyone was sort of hungry at the time for a different style of play, and he produced that. And he produced something that they thought was progressive and heading towards the future. So he got a lot of accolades. But I remember doing a bunch of shows where everyone laughed at me when I said that he is nothing below, but he's always going to be mediocre or below than that. And I'm glad on that point I got proved right. Now, when it comes to Eusebio Di Francesco, I think it's very hard. It's a little bit like a Mainz Borussia Dortmund situation in Germany. And I can compare that to Sassuolo for me in Italy. It's a very well-run club and they choose their coaches very well. They have a balanced team. The owner, who is a Milan fan, made a note at the time, you know, Squinzi, unfortunately, is no longer with us, but he had made it very clear at the time that, you know, these are the men in charge and no one overlaps. You know, these are your tasks and this is how we run this club and this is how we be successful. And I think it's one of the sides in Italy that I really do always want to tip my hat to, because they understand, everyone understands their role so well. And for that, that's why they have successful coaches. Now, the problem is that when you are given that level of support, when you do have a team and management team that is around you all the time, and you are allowed to indulge in your stylistic ways, then it becomes much harder when you move on to other clubs with different ambitions, perhaps not as much support. And Di Francesco did something wonderful with Sassuolo. He really put them on the map, but I think he never found that capability of doing it elsewhere. He did do a remarkable thing with Roma in defeating Barcelona, but it's always become harder. And these are the things that worry me about De Zerbi as well. You know, you can play that style of play. You do have a very good team. So sometimes I do think he's overrated, because it's like we forget how good that team is or how many of them are in the Italian national team. But my worry is that going on and moving on, are you going to find that support? Are you going to find that management side? And is it going to be that way? And you see there's a lot who have succeeded in Mainz and Borussia Dortmund as players and as coaches that perhaps haven't taken that further, other than obviously the main ones like Roman Lewandowski.
Well, both Marco Giampaolo and Eusebio Di Francesco sacked from both Cagliari and Torino this season. Probably going to see some more sackings in the bottom of the table. Crotone probably has no chance under Serse Cosmi, which is a bit of a shame given the way that they played and some of the brilliant individual players that they have, like Junior Macias and Adam Unas, who came on loan, and even Simeone Nkwonkwo, who's been scoring at a rate as good as anyone in Europe the last 2 months. So Crotone, 12 points from safety. They're down the Serie B. It really does not look good for Parma either in 19th place. And then there's 18th place Cagliari, who are 5 points behind Torino. And when I was doing my paper rankings of talent of the top teams for the season, I look back at it, I had Fiorentina 9th and I had Cagliari in 10th place, which I don't think is that far-fetched. When you actually take a look at the players that Cagliari have on paper, this is a side that should be comfortably mid-table. So it got me thinking and wondering, who are the most talented sides that have gone down? I couldn't think of that many. I remember Palermo from 2012-2013 that had Miccoli and Dybala and Abel Hernandez and a few others. That was a pretty talented side when you look back that went down to Serie B about 10 years ago. But this Cagliari team, if they do go down to Serie B, probably one of the better teams that we've seen drop down, right?
So then what does that say? That does it say that, you know, teams in the bottom half, is it about the players you have or is it about the coach that's installed?
Well, probably the coaches, right? Because Vincenzo Italiano at Spezia, I had them as 19th place in terms of talent, just above Crotone. They're overachieving. Elas Verona's overachieving. Benevento under Pippo Inzaghi has been overachieving because they're not in the bottom three.
Yeah. No, it has, which goes to show you that perhaps, I mean, I think why Italy is so good, right, it's considered the tactical league because tactics mask deficiencies within a squad. You know, if you're a well-organized side, then you can try to make up for the fact that you might not have specific talent in certain areas. And I think that the great tacticians like Spezia's coach right now, Vincenzo Italiano, or like, you know, Crotone's Cosmi, who is doing fantastic stuff. There's a psychological problem there, which is when they concede, they tend to, you know, sometimes lose it. But other than that, like, it is, unfortunately, when you look at the way that Cagliari has handled the different changes, and perhaps that's had an impact, because when you look at that squad, I agree with you, they should be comfortably mid-table. And Hellas Verona, without a striker, they're still such a delight to watch, even over the weekend when they lost to Lazio. It's just, they're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant tactically.
Was the question the most talented team ever to be relegated from Serie A? Mm. Because there was a Juventus team in 2006 that had Buffon.
Okay, but I'm going to leave
after throwing that grenade into the
scandals. Because then you could even go down to Milan in the 80s. I mean, there's let's pretend like the reasons outside of football never happened. That only got relegated because of il calcio sul campo, il calcio che conta, right? The football that matters.
Parma, when they got relegated, were pretty good as well. But I guess it does that count?
When they went into administration because they couldn't even pay the players. They had Antonio Cassano. Remember, that was a team that didn't even have hot water to shower. Crazy situation. So it seems like we might have some very talented teams going down to Serie B. I think of Parma as well with Karl Kraus, the American owner, who's trying to refurbish and redo the Ennio Tardini, the stadium in Parma, and bought so many young players. Cagliari as well, the only team representing Sardinia, the beautiful island in Serie A. So maybe it's time to start watching a bit more Serie B next season. Things could be spicy at the top of the table. Let's end the show as we always do with final thoughts. These are the ruminations that have kept up both Nikki and Mina the last few nights. Nikki, let's start with you.
I just felt like we needed to say a quick word on Roma because since we last recorded, they got a really, for me at least, quite unexpected 2-1 win away to Ajax in the Europa League quarterfinal. I think this was put really well by someone on an Italian language podcast, La Riserva. If you are an Italian language listener who likes football, definitely check that one out. But one of their hosts is a big Roma fan and talked about the fact that, yes, it wasn't a perfect performance, but all season long, Roma, anytime you thought there was a chance they could disappoint you, they found a way to disappoint you. This time they did the opposite. You thought they were going to disappoint you and they didn't. Look, they're in a very strong position to go through to the Europa League semi-final. By the time you listen to this, you may already know, but I think something good yet could come of what's been a very difficult second half to the season for Paolo Fonseca.
I wonder how much or how, yeah, how much Roma could have achieved if they just had a little bit more support from everyone around them. Because I do feel like the energy there is always like waiting for someone to fail. And I just wonder if there was just a bit more, yeah, okay, we're doing it, it's fine, it doesn't matter. But rather than just expectations of top four, you have to do this, you have to finish that, you have to do this. They've been amazing. Only team left in Europe right now. Like you said, you know, all of this constant rumors about everyone arguing with everyone is going to destabilize a club. Obviously, it's going to destabilize a club. And I just wish that they were just surrounded by a lot more happiness and positive energy, because I do think they would be able to achieve even more than they manage.
Well, my final thought is just how good the Serie A race at the top of the table is going to be. One big team is going to miss out. Is it going to be Atalanta? Is it going to be Napoli? Are we going to get surprised and maybe see Juventus or Milan drop out of the top four? What's certain, I think, though, is that with the way that the Serie A is getting better at the top of the table, there's actually going to be a much better push next season in the Champions League from Italian sides. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Serie A Awesome. For myself, for Mita, for Nikki, as Kay would say, ciao for now.